Pacifico Radio. This is Democracy Now! It's the first time in history that a foreign country is suing a U.S. multinational in a U.S. court. We'll talk to the Attorney General of Ecuador about his country's suit against Texaco. Also, arrests of protesters this week at the Rockefeller Foundation. What is its connection to the 2,000 people still part of the Detroit newspaper strike? And as ports are privatized around the world, dockers throughout the West Coast strike in solidarity with dock workers in Liverpool. All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. The New York Times is reporting today Maria Haley, a longtime aide to President Clinton, who is now an appointee of his at the Export-Import Bank, tried last year to push through an unusual $6.5 million financing deal sought by a woman whose large donations to the Democratic Party are under investigation. This according to interviews and government records. The proposed deal called for the government bank to help a company controlled by one of Thailand's wealthiest families finance a blockbuster video store franchise in Bangkok. President Clinton is willing to compromise with Republicans on an array of issues. The president, in an interview with the Wall Street Journal, strongly predicted a deal on balancing the budget. He also called for a bipartisan commission to study Social Security and Medicare reforms, adding he may support raising Medicare premiums for wealthier senior citizens and increasing the Social Security eligibility age. Many fear that once the premiums are increased for wealthier senior citizens, the next step is poorer senior citizens. The Senate cleared Clinton's nominees for Secretaries of State and Defense. The confirmation votes were unanimous for, respectively, former U.N. envoy Madeleine Albright and former Senator William Cohen. Albright is the first woman in the post, and Cohen will be the only cabinet Republican. Russian President Boris Yeltsin made an unexpected appearance at the Kremlin for a meeting with Prime Minister Chernomyrdin, derailing a vote in the Duma to call for the Russian president to step down because of ill health. The largely symbolic bill failed 102-87. Doctors criticized Yeltsin's move, saying he hasn't fully recovered from pneumonia. South Korea's opposition rejected the president's offer to submit a new labor law to parliament for possible revision. Opposition and union leaders insisted the law, passed in a secret session attended only by ruling party members, be revoked. Workers held the first of what they say will be weekly one-day strikes. Canada's foreign minister met with Cuban President Fidel Castro in Havana on a visit that has drawn sharp criticism from the United States. Meanwhile, the State Department confirmed it has sent letters to an Israeli and a Panamanian company warning that their executives face a U.S. travel ban because of alleged violations of recently tightened Cuba sanctions. South Africa's deputy president said the U.S. would be consulted before any action was taken on a proposed sale of an anti-tank weapon system to Syria. The U.S. has threatened to cut off aid to South Africa if the sale goes through. President Mandela told the U.S. not to dictate to his government. Vice President Gore condemned those who attack abortion clinics as terrorists in a speech at a meeting marking the 24th anniversary of the Supreme Court ruling that legalized abortion. Thousands of opponents marched nearby, and a bomb scare took place hours before the meeting began. Meanwhile, dynamite, which is rarely used by amateur bombers, was in both bombs that exploded outside an Atlanta abortion clinic last week. The explosives were high-grade commercial dynamite, according to CBS News. The bomber used 10 to 20 sticks of dynamite in each bomb. The first bomb on January 16th blew a hole in a clinic wall. As police officers and emergency medical personnel flooded the area, a second explosive went off in an adjoining parking lot, injuring six people. And you're listening to Democracy Now! For the first time, and over strenuous objections from the Clinton administration, a foreign government is suing a U.S. oil company in an American court over environmental destruction of its rainforest. The government of Ecuador recently reversed its position on the landmark case and filed papers on the side of Ecuadorian Indians in the U.S. District Court in White Plains, New York. The Indians say they suffer from severe medical problems as a result of Texaco's oil drilling in the lush rainforest region of Oriente. Texaco, which has just settled a $100 million race discrimination lawsuit, denies the charges. Joining us to talk about this unprecedented suit is the Attorney General of Ecuador. He is Leonidas Plaza Verduga. We're also joined by Cristobal Boniface. He is the lead attorney representing the Ecuadorian Indians and a native Ecuadorian himself. And Cristobal Boniface will also translate for the Attorney General of Ecuador. We welcome you both to Democracy Now!
Thank you.
Well,
thank you.
Why don't we begin by you telling us, Attorney General, what your lawsuit is all about.
¿Qué quiere que le explique de qué se trata la intervención del Ecuador en este caso?
Good morning, thank you. Estamos acá en los Estados Unidos para presionar por parte del gobierno ecuatoriano a los jueces y corte de Nueva York para que se atienda el justo reclamo de los colonos e indígenas de la Amazonía.
We are here in New York to ask the proper authorities, including the judicial authorities, to make certain that they attend the cases that have been filed on behalf of the indigenous people of the Amazon.
Que inicialmente fueron postergados por uno de los jueces de la corte acá, aduciendo que no tenían el respaldo del gobierno ecuatoriano.
Because the case had been dismissed on the grounds that it did not have the backing of the Ecuadorian government. That was the argument that the judge used, according to those.
Sin embargo, en mi calidad de procurador general y representante del gobierno ecuatoriano, he manifestado ya públicamente y mediante escritos ante el juez que sí respaldamos a los colonos indígenas de la Amazonía.
What he wants to make certain is that the judge understands that this is an erroneous assumption because the Ecuadorian government is 100% behind the plight of the indigenous people of the Amazon.
Que sufren una serie de problemas por la irracional explotación petrolífera ejecutada por la Texaco.
Who are suffering now tremendous catastrophic problems because of the type of exploitation of oil that Texaco carried out in Ecuador.
Que ha causado una estela de muerte y destrucción en la Amazonía ecuatoriana.
Which has caused large amounts of death and destruction in the Ecuadorian Amazon.
No solo al ecosistema, sino también a las vidas humanas.
Not only to the ecosystem, but to human lives.
Y estimamos que la Texaco está en la obligación de reparar los daños causados.
And we believe that Texaco is under obligation to make all the proper reparation so that the damage stops.
Ha contaminado el ambiente.
It has contaminated the environment.
Los habitantes de la región amazónica sufren de enfermedades graves.
The inhabitants of the Amazonian region are suffering from serious illnesses.
Han engañado al gobierno porque no han cubierto las lagunas llenas de petróleo. Tal como se comprometieron.
They have cheated the government of Ecuador because they have not gone through with their promises to fill the oil lagoons that they left there.
El agua que contiene partículas de petróleo destruye los esteros y los ríos de la Amazonía.
The water that they have dumped contains particulate oil and salts that destroys the Amazonian rainforest.
Y todo ello pues obliga a que mi calidad de procurador salga en defensa de mis nacionales.
And this puts the responsibility on me to come out on the side of my people.
Sin embargo, aquí los jueces, desconociendo convenios internacionales recíprocos.
However, here in the United States, judges are not recognizing international treaties
vigentes desde 1839.
That are valid since 1839.
Causan discrimen.
They're causing discriminatory actions.
A los ecuatorianos.
Ecuadorian citizens.
Cuando acuden a demandar ante los jueces acá en los Estados Unidos.
When they come to sue somebody in front of an American court.
Let me ask you something. Texaco is already been very vulnerable because of the suit it was just forced to settle, the $100 million race discrimination lawsuit that was forced on it because of tapes that surfaced of high-level executives speaking in very racist language. Would you say there's any connection between that kind of racism and what Texaco did in the indigenous homelands of Ecuador?
Texaco has been on the, Texaco ha estado en el tremendo amount of problemas aquí por la acción
and
discriminatoria
folks,
que le llevaron los empleados de ella por tratamiento mal a gente no blanca. Y la pregunta que le hace la señorita es que si usted cree que hay alguna conexión en el tratamiento de los
Only
de
I would give him such a long question to translate.
Bueno, da la imagen que aquí somos postergados, partiendo también del punto que la Texaco dice que ha firmado un convenio con el Ministerio de Energía de mi país.
Yeah, he's what he's saying is yes, there is the image that we are being discriminated against, and particularly because Texaco is making the allegation that they have signed a contract with the prior government.
Convenio que es nulo.
That agreement between Texaco and the prior government to clean up the environment is null and void.
Porque no tiene la opinión del Procurador General del Estado anterior.
Because he was never approved by the prior Attorney General of Ecuador.
Es un requisito legal.
That's a requirement of the law in Ecuador that such an approval was required before the contract was signed.
Y la posición mía la he informado al Presidente de la República del Ecuador.
And have informed the analysis that we have made in the Attorney General's office to the President of Ecuador,
al Congreso Nacional de mi país,
to the National Congress of Ecuador,
a la Embajada de los Estados Unidos en mi país,
to the American Embassy in Ecuador,
y también a la Procuradora General de los Estados
and
Unidos,
also to Jen Reno.
We are talking to Attorney General of Ecuador, Leonidas Plaza Verduga. We're also joined by Cristobal Bonifaz, who's translating, but has been involved with the Ecuadorian Indians for quite a while, representing them in the U.S. court, suing Texaco. Let me ask you about the history of this case, even before the Ecuadorian government entered, Cristobal Bonifaz.
Well, this case was filed in November of 1993 and alleges catastrophic environmental and human damage caused by Texaco's erroneous technology that was used in Ecuador to extract oil.
For how long?
For 20 years. Basically, what Texaco did is dump the wastes into the environment, which the waste that should have been reinjected into the ground, that's done in every civilized country in the world. This continuous dumping of the waste is what caused all the problems in the Amazon. The case was filed in November of 1993. Texaco made a number of motions to dismiss the case. The initial judge we had in the case, Judge Vincent Broderick, former police commissioner of New York, and a judge that was in the bench for about 40 years, ruled that we can continue with the case provided that we can show that all the decisions that led to this case were made in the United States, and he allowed us to go into discovery to that issue. We went into discovery of that issue. Judge Broderick unfortunately passed away in March of 1995. The case was assigned to a second judge, Judge Barrington Parker of the Southern District. And at that point, Texaco came into the court and said, we have reached this agreement with the government of Ecuador that now the government of Ecuador is declaring a null and void. And they argue in front of the court that because that agreement had been reached, the case should be dismissed. At that point, Judge Barrington Parker, through his magistrate, Margaret Smith, said that it's immaterial to the court, that the law in the case was Judge Broderick's law. And Judge Broderick had already ruled that the government of Ecuador's opinion in this matter was irrelevant because he was going to equalize the playing field by creating the standard. The case got transferred from Judge Barrington Parker to a third judge in March of 1996, and this third judge has dismissed the case. We dismissed the case in November on the argument that Ecuador had to be a party to the case and on the ground that this is not a convenient forum for the litigation.
Didn't this judge also have some unusual connections?
I don't want to make any comments on that.
Okay. So he dismissed it, and the
yes.
other two judges, over the ruling of the other two judges.
Well, he had a different opinion from the other two judges, right.
So where does that leave you right now?
Well, at that point, the government of Ecuador and Attorney General of Ecuador announced that he was going to come in into the case, given that Ecuador did not want the case dismissed, that he that Ecuador was going to come into the case, and we have asked the judge to reconsider his position, given the fact that his arguments for dismissing this case are invalid now, given the fact that Ecuador has changed his mind on it. So there's pending in the courts right now a motion to reconsider the decision based on the fact that Ecuador has actually made a motion to intervene. The judge has in his hands both documents, the motion to intervene by the government of Ecuador and our motion to reconsider, and is right now studying those documents.
Why did the previous Ecuadorian government, before Mr. Plaza was the attorney general, why did it not join the case?
Well, I think that there was, as the attorney general could comment, and he commented this morning, there was a lot of confusion in the prior government of Ecuador because nobody paid any attention to this case in Ecuador to a point. The Ecuadorian ambassador in Washington, Mr. Edgar Terán, who later on we found out had a law firm associated with Texaco's lawyers in Ecuador, as they themselves acknowledged in Martindale and Hubble, he is the one that told the judge that Ecuador was opposed to the case. But the Congress of Ecuador notified Judge Rakoff in June of this year by an unanimous decision that the Congress of Ecuador supported the people of the Amazon. So it was the Congress of Ecuador versus Mr. Terán, which is also on the record to have been associated with the law firm of Texaco's lawyers in Ecuador. What Mr. Leonidas Plaza has done is to say, well, you know, Mr. Terán did not speak for the government, and we are speaking now for the government. Our position is 100% solid behind the people.
How much would it cost Texaco to clean up the Amazon?
Well, it's not a question of clean up. I think Texaco has to be obliged to go back to Ecuador and put in place the infrastructure required so the pollution stops. The cost of that, we have experts' estimates that have estimated the cost about $680 million to put the infrastructure in place so that the pollution no longer goes forward.
We are joined on the telephone in this last few minutes by Paulina Garcon. She will be at the news conference today that the Attorney General of Ecuador will be holding to announce this lawsuit, the joining of the Ecuadorian government against Texaco. Paulina Garcon is from Quito, Ecuador, and she's with Acción Ecológica, which is Environmental Action. And she and about 50 others sat in at the Attorney General's office a few months ago to encourage the new Attorney General to come up to the United States to put the force of the Ecuadorian government behind this lawsuit. We welcome you to Democracy Now! And I wanted to ask you about why you're here in the United States right now, Paulina.
Muchas gracias por esta oportunidad. Estoy aquí para algunas reuniones con organizaciones ambientalistas y difundir la campaña para que Texaco tome responsabilidad por los daños.
Thank you very much for inviting me to the program. I'm here to meet with environmental groups in the north to help support the campaign against Texaco and, in fact, the international boycott against Texaco.
And what are you doing, actually? I know the Ecuadorian government is not calling for an international boycott against Texaco. Why are you?
Bueno, queremos llamar la atención a la sociedad civil para que también las personas sepan que pueden hacer algo individualmente, que no le den un voto de confianza a Texaco comprando sus productos.
We want to make sure that the civil society also has a role in this issue and that they should know that they shouldn't give their vote to Texaco with each purchase of Texaco products.
What has been the effect of the pollution, of Texaco's presence in Ecuador, in the base communities in the Amazon that you work with?
Han habido impactos en el aire, en el suelo, en el agua, en la salud de las comunidades, pero creo que el más importante ha sido el envenenamiento de las fuentes de agua.
There's been impacts in the air, the soil, and also the health of the people, but the most destructive thing has been the poisoning of their water.
And what can people do about it here if people are interested in getting organized?
La propuesta es justamente el boicot, no comprar los productos de Texaco hasta que Texaco no repare la Amazonía ecuatoriana.
The proposal is simply that people join this boycott against Texaco and not consume or buy Texaco products until Texaco has agreed to clean up the damage that it's done in Ecuador.
If people want to get more information on the international boycott, is there a phone number that they can call?
Hay tres puntos focales en los Estados Unidos, en Nueva York, con el Centro de Derechos Económicos Sociales, en San Francisco con Rainforest Action Network y en Washington con la Coalición de Apoyo a los Pueblos Indígenas de la Amazonía.
There are three places that people can call. In San Francisco, there's Rainforest Action Network at 415-398-4404.
One more time.
415-398-4404. The Center for Economic and Social Rights in New York, 212-982-1950.
Again.
212-982-1950. And the Coalition in Support of Amazon People in Washington at 202-637-9718.
And I wanted to end by asking the Attorney General, will you be meeting with Janet Reno, the Attorney General of the United States?
¿Que si usted tiene plans de entrevistarse con la Attorney General Reno?
Sí, yo voy a entrevistarme con ella, pero antes quisiera también hacer un llamado a los ciudadanos de aquí, de este país, que por favor defiendan la Amazonía, que es el pulmón del mundo, uno de los pocos pulmones que queda.
He is going to go to Washington and meet with Janet Reno, but he wants to call to an American people to help save the lungs of the world, which is the Amazonian rainforest.
Y si estas transnacionales destruyen la Amazonía, no solo que nos están matando a nuestros indígenas, sino que están matando a la humanidad.
If these transnationals destroy the Amazon, they not only will destroy the Amazon, but they will destroy the whole world because the Amazon is the lung of the world.
Y voy a hablar con la Attorney General de los Estados Unidos para pedirle la reciprocidad que debe existir entre los gobiernos de mi país y el de acá.
He's going to ask Attorney General Reno for the reciprocity that should exist between the government of the United States and Ecuador. He's talking about the fact that in the judicial treaties, Americans are free to call to Ecuadorian courts and sue, and Ecuadorian citizens have been told they cannot come to America and sue American corporations.
Well, I want to thank you for joining us and let people know two other numbers if they're interested in letting Attorney General Janet Reno know what you think, as well as Peter Bijar, who is the CEO of Texaco. Janet Reno's number in Washington, D.C. is 202-514-2000. That's 202-514-2000. And Peter Bijar, the chair of Texaco, his number in White Plains, New York, 914-253-4000. That's 914-253-4000. I want to thank you very much for joining us, the Ecuadorian Attorney General Leonidas Plaza Verduga, as well as Cristobal Boniface, the lead attorney representing the Ecuadorian Indians. And I also want to thank Paulina Garcon with Acción Ecológica in Quito, Ecuador. You're listening to Democracy Now! I think that's an important thought and description to go out with. The Ecuadorian rainforest, the lungs of the world. You're listening to Democracy Now! We'll be back in 60 seconds. You're listening to Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. I'm Amy Goodman. Earlier this week, 10 Detroit newspaper strikers were arrested in New York City inside the offices of the Rockefeller Foundation. After a strike lasting 18 months, the 2,000 striking workers at the Detroit News and the Detroit Free Press are taking their campaign right to the board members of Gannett and Knight Ridder, the owners of the papers. The newspaper chains are demanding the elimination of hundreds of jobs and the end of union representation at the newspapers. We want to welcome both of our guests, Greg Weathers, who is a striking maintenance worker, and Bob Orleon, a striking reporter. Hi. Why don't we start by you telling us about this protest this week inside the offices of the Rockefeller Foundation. Bob, you were arrested?
Yeah, I was. The protest was actually part of a series of protests across several states this week. The strikers and their supporters are getting together here in New York and also in Washington, Virginia. We're going to be going to Connecticut and Massachusetts and Florida to pay visits to directors of Knight Ridder Company and to the Gannett Company. Now, these are both large national newspaper companies that each own a newspaper in Detroit. Gannett's the biggest one in the country. Knight Ridder is number two. They each own a paper in Detroit, and they have a combined business operation there known as a joint operating agreement, or JOA. And since they began making money with this JOA and through concessions given by unions, they've embarked on this union-busting campaign in Detroit, as you mentioned, involving more than 2,000 families. We have been basically at a stalemate. It doesn't seem to be any amount of losses that are too great for them to endure. We've crippled their business, their credibility in Detroit shot, and yet they don't seem to want to bargain seriously because they want to pursue this union busting campaign. So we've come to New York, and we're going to Washington, Virginia, and elsewhere to pay visits on the members of the boards of directors of these companies. Who management has to answer to.
Explain who the member of the board is you were protesting here in New York.
At the Rockefeller Foundation, the president is a guy named Peter Goldmark, Jr. He's a fairly prominent guy. The Rockefeller Foundation likes to be associated with philanthropic causes. And in fact, Mr. Goldmark himself has been mentioned as a candidate for the next commissioner of Major League Baseball. So he's pretty well known, but he's also a director of Knight Ridder, and he's been one of the directors that has sat silently on this board while his management has engaged in this illegal union busting campaign in Detroit.
What was the response of the Rockefeller Foundation with all of you coming up?
Well, we initially started out with a picket line and demonstration outside the offices there. And we decided since Mr. Goldmark had not responded to a letter that we would go inside and ask for a meeting. And about 40 or 50 of us did that and ended up in the lobby of the foundation offices. And when he indicated he didn't want to meet with us, we sort of demonstrated some of our chanting and so forth. And in fact, he did end up hearing our message. And they called the police on us.
How many people were arrested?
As we were leaving the offices, the police nabbed the last 10 people leaving. I was one of them, and I have to say that the Midtown South guys were pretty decent fellows. I guess they were telling us about some of their upcoming contract problems, which have since broken in the news. But and they seemed to want to show some solidarity. Unfortunately, they were overruled by the Rockefeller Foundation and by the building management, who insisted on pressing charges.
Yeah, speaking of the police, the front page of the New York Times today: heads of former transit police union are indicted. So let's hope that doesn't happen to you. Greg Weathers, tell us about how you first got involved with this strike.
Well, I've been with the Detroit newspaper about 3 years now, and it was just one of those things that there were certain things that were going on that we knew that, where it was going. Like in my department, we have a two-tier pay system. If you're pre-JOA, there's a wage you make. If you're post-JOA, there's a wage that you make. And it's kind of like putting one worker against the other, where, I'm standing beside a guy, I'm doing the same job he's doing, but since he's pre-JOA, he makes $5 an hour more than I do.
And how did they get away with this disparity in wages?
By using the JOA.
This joint agreement.
Joint operating agreement.
Mm-hmm. Joint operating agreement, I might add, was approved in 1989 under the Newspaper Preservation Act. The Newspaper Preservation Act was meant to prevent the destruction of newspapers through cutthroat competition. Well, we've since begun calling it the Union Destruction Act, because newspapers are using the Preservation Act to join forces, combine their profits, and then go after their unions. And it's something we have a petition before the Justice Department seeking to dissolve the JOA in Detroit because of this illegal behavior.
Do you ever get any coverage of your strike in Gannett or Knight Ridder newspapers around the country?
Well, very little. And usually what is, you know, what we see in their papers is their slant on things, not the proper slant on. You know, we're always being violent or, you know, breaking the law, you know, never saying that they were doing things to cause these things.
How have you managed to maintain this for more than a year and a half? How are you surviving, by the way?
Well, it's a struggle, but, you know, in Detroit, we're workers, we're used to struggling, and you just tighten your belt a little bit and cut corners where you can.
And you have a union strike fund?
You know, there's actually six unions on strike. 2,000 people are members of six different unions. And each of the unions, they vary from union to union, but there are strike funds that all the unions, you know, we're getting pretty much a paycheck every week. In addition to that, other locals around the country have been very supportive, be they newspaper unions or other unions, and have contributed money, sent food and clothing. They've adopted strikers by giving monthly checks to help with our support, and in general, help the legal cause and everything like that. It's a high profile struggle because it really is about the right of Americans to join a union.
Tell us about the newspaper that has been developed, that has been published since the strike has been on.
Well, we started the Detroit Sunday Journal. Even though the Detroit News and Detroit Free Press, the dailies, in some form or fashion, however wobbly, however misguided and error-ridden, have continued publishing during the strike, there's a vacuum in the city, and people that are sympathetic to labor, to the arts, to culture, to the various movements, needed a newspaper of their own, and in fact needed a TV guide of their own, needed a crossword puzzle of their own. And so we began the Detroit Sunday Journal a little over a year ago. It publishes every Sunday. It's the largest circulating weekly newspaper now in Michigan. It's enjoying some tremendous journalistic success. We've scored major scoops over the dailies.
Like what?
Well, there's for instance there was a big mafia corruption probe going on in Detroit. That story was broken in the Sunday Journal. There have been some major environmental problems in landfills and so forth around Metro Detroit. Those stories were broken in the Sunday Journal.
If people want to get copies, or rather a subscription to the Detroit Sunday Journal, is there a number that they can call?
Absolutely. The Sunday Journal sells for the subscriptions are $15 for 3 months. And the easiest way to get one is to call the Sunday Journal's switchboard at 313-567-9818.
Again?
313-567-9818.
In addition to Bob Orlean, who's a striking reporter, and Greg Weathers, who's a striking worker, we're also joined by Sean Ellis, who is a striking driver. And again, we're talking about the Detroit newspaper strike, the 2,000 striking workers at the Detroit News and the Detroit Free Press. How did you get involved, Sean?
Well, previously to the JOA, I had started on the Free Press side, and I have 10 years invested in this company. And when the time came on July 13th, when contract negotiations broke down, thrown right into the middle of this high-profile media strike.
Do you find it's difficult because your union striking, or six unions striking at the media, that the rest of the media doesn't want to cover you?
It's really been a struggle to try to get, and especially when you have two corporations owning more than 130 newspapers. So it's it's quite great to be able to come to New York and be able to get our message out on this medium.
And what kind of support have you gotten in Detroit, and what kind of reaction has there been to those who continue at the Detroit papers?
We've got support from the religious community. Over 850 religious leaders have come together and signed a petition calling for meaningful negotiations. We've had support from the community by droves of hundreds of thousands of readers not reading these papers anymore. And we also had the support of the business community, maybe for varying reasons, but realizing that it does not make good business sense to advertise in these struck papers.
But what is also the reaction, maybe Greg, you could tell us, the reaction to those who are working at these struck papers, at the Detroit News and the Detroit Free Press, and how do you respond to them?
As far as the scabs, I'm sorry. As far as the scabs, the reaction, I think that low morale, you know, folks who dread coming, you know, I see it as folks who dread coming to work, they know that sooner or later they could be in our position. You know, when this strike is finally over, and when we get back to work, you know, they'll be on the outside looking in.
Mm-hmm. What about fellow and sister reporters, Bob?
Well, a number of them, as you may have heard, stayed on strike for a while and then crossed the line and, as we say, went back inside. They're not the better ones by any means. The reporters and photographers that stayed out, I think, by far are the better ones. That's how we've been able to scoop them so frequently. But they're, you know, as Greg said, their morale is decimated. I mean, they've been made scabs, and they were told by management that they're journalists, they're professionals after all, and they don't need to belong to a union. When in reality, you know, reporters in this day and age still do need a union, as I'm sure reporters at staffs at the New York dailies and elsewhere around the country are well aware. I mean, we need a union, and we have a right to a union, which is what the strike is all about. Just as any other newspaper, any other medium, really, this very radio station is. You know, people have the right to a union, and increasingly media companies are attacking that right.
Sean Ellis, what has been the support of other unions, and particularly the AFL-CIO?
Stepping forward with staff members, with funding, the AFL-CIO as well as some of its member affiliates have stepped forward and put seed money down for the Detroit Sunday Journal. From the international level right down to the locals, that for instance in Chicago there's an ITU group that takes a weekly collection after payday.
ITU means?
International Typographical, that take a collection each week after at the Sun Times. So it varies. It's from one end of the spectrum to the other.
Do you expect to go back to work?
Absolutely.
Right.
Absolutely. That goes for me too.
And how long do you expect this to last? I mean, if they have a full staff at both places, if they have a full staff at the Detroit News and the Detroit Free Press, why should they respond to you outside?
Ultimately, they're going to have to respond to us outside. There are legal reasons that they'll have to, moral reasons and political reasons. And we are bringing the pressure to bear on all of those fronts.
What has been the progress in the courts?
Well, in the courts, of course, we're at the level of the National Labor Relations Board. A very, very slow-moving process, and a process that's obviously been tailored for many, many years by people with corporate interests. Although, you know, the staff of the various staffs of the NLRB have been very, very well-meaning people, the process is very cumbersome for unions. We are at a level, but the government is charging the company with a dozen charges that says that they provoked and have prolonged the strike by their illegal, unfair labor practices. And that we've had a lengthy trial, full-blown trial in front of an administrative law judge, and we're waiting for a ruling from him.
Do the media mergers, the massive ones at the highest levels, do they have any effect on you striking outside in Detroit?
Yes, they do, because they've shut us out as far as being able to get our voice out into the community. 2,000 workers are affected by this, and yet we cannot get into mainstream press with some of our activities, just trying to get our message out into the community. The local press within Detroit, as far as the alternatives, have been covering us. But outside the city, it's been really difficult to get our message out.
If people want to keep up on this, since clearly we're not going to get it from the corporate media, how can they keep up on the activities of the strikers?
Well, the Detroit Sunday Journal is definitely one source, and we've given the number for that. Another source is the through the Council of Unions in Detroit, which does have a website. At the Detroit Journal, and I'm not real good at extremely computer literate, but
www.rust.net/
and then there's a squiggly line, and then it says workers/strike.html.
Oh my God! One more time.
Should we try that again? www.rust.net/squiggly line. workers/strike.html.
And where are you headed now?
Well, from here we're headed to the state line. We're going to Connecticut to pay a visit to another member of the board of directors, and then from there we're going to Boston to see a couple of more.
Well, I want to thank you very much for joining us, and why don't you give out one more time the phone number of the Detroit Sunday Journal?
The Detroit Sunday Journal, 313-567-9818.
Well, thanks for joining us.
Sean Ellis
is a striking driver, Greg Weathers, a striking maintenance worker, and Bob Orlean, a striking reporter, part of the 2,000 striking families at the Detroit News and the Detroit Free Press. Good luck in your journey. You're listening to Democracy Now! And we come back, we're going to talk about another union struggle, and it's one that spans from Liverpool, England, to California. And it's a very interesting one, also not getting much attention. You're listening to Democracy Now! We'll be back in 60 seconds. You're listening to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. As we were just talking about the media, I should point out, and people may have heard about this yesterday, a federal jury in Greensboro, North Carolina, awarded a supermarket chain more than $5.5 million in punitive damages from ABC and two of its employees in a closely watched case that focused on the propriety of widely used television news techniques like hidden cameras and undercover reporters. Last month, the same panel ordered ABC to pay $1,400 in actual damages to the chain, Food Lion, after finding that network producers had trespassed and committed fraud when researching a primetime live segment in '92 that accused the company of selling spoiled meat. The case has attracted broad attention in journalistic and legal circles because it's a leading example of a new trend in lawsuits against networks and TV news magazines. Although Food Lion officials disputed the accuracy of the ABC report, they did not sue for libel. Rather, they accused ABC of fraud because it used techniques like having producers submit fake resumes to get jobs in the meat department of the company stores and then use hidden cameras to film there. I don't know. I call that creativity. But following up on our last segment with the Detroit strikers, one of our guests was wearing a pin that said, we support the Merseyside Dockers. And we had asked him about this yesterday when we saw him and decided to do a story that also is not covered very much in the mainstream media. Dock workers all over the world went out on strike this past Monday, which was Martin Luther King's birthday. On the West Coast, workers in five of the biggest ports, Seattle, Tacoma, Portland, Oakland, and Los Angeles, Long Beach, they held a one-day work stoppage. They were joined by thousands of dockers all over the world who downed tools, occupied offices, and refused to load cargo or simply work slowly. The spark for what some observers are calling one of the first coordinated international strikes in history was a call by dockers in Liverpool to fight the privatization of ports and what's being called the casualization of work on the docks. The Liverpool dockers, some 500 of them, have been on strike now for 16 months. And joining us to talk about this strike on both sides of the ocean are Terry Teague, a shop steward and the coordinator of international actions for the sacked Liverpool dockers, and Jack Heyman, who is an executive board member of the San Francisco Longshoremen's Union. Why don't we begin with Terry Teague? Welcome from Liverpool. Why don't you tell us what started this whole strike 16 months ago?
Hello, Amy, and good morning.
Morning.
Yes, my name's Terry Teague, and I'm representing 500 sacked Liverpool dock workers. And the start of our struggle and the start of our dispute was going back to September of 1995. It was 500 dockers, longshoremen, who were sacked by their employer, the Mersey Docks and Harbour Company, for refusing to cross a picket line. Now, the picket line had been set up by the young dock workers in our industry who'd been unfairly dismissed by their employer. We'd refused to cross that picket line, which should be the number one principle of all trade unionists across the world. And because of that, the company that we're in struggle with, the Mersey Docks and Harbour Company, use the political and industrial legislation that operates within the United Kingdom to sack us all.
Now, why should dockers in California, in Washington, and Oregon care about you in Liverpool?
Because I think the main reason why workers should care about one another is that there is a huge global attack, and it's not just in Liverpool and in England, but it's throughout many countries across the world now, where there is a global attack on workers' rights, workers' conditions, whereby employers now seem to think that they can take away the working conditions, good rates of pay, and entitlements of workers so that they can increase their profits. And so the words of casualization, deregulation, and privatization, they don't just go in the port of Liverpool, but they do go to many, many countries around the world, and certainly to many dock workers around the world. We've got a common interest in the jobs we do, and I think we've got a common interest in the employer that we fight, because unless we do things on a united and global basis, it's the view of many, many workers that what's happening in Liverpool could happen to any port or any group of workers across the world.
You described the first 80 young workers who were sacked and then the others who went out on strike in support of them. In fact, those others, many of them were their fathers. Is that right?
That's correct. There has been a long tradition within the dock industry that, sons follow their fathers into the docks, they follow them into their jobs. And when these young workers were sacked, there were many of them. Many of them had fathers who worked in the traditional dock areas, as we call them, in Liverpool, who actually came out in support of of their son's dismissal. They refused to cross picket lines. In many ways, people have said since, because, in 16 months you do find out a lot of information what was behind the dismissal of the dock workers, but people have told us since that it was an emotive issue, that it was deliberately done, that they would sack sons of dock workers knowing that there would be a picket line set up and it would be impossible for anyone faced with that dilemma to go across and go to work.
Let's... Let's bring Jack Heyman into the conversation, executive board member of the San Francisco Longshoremen's Union. How did you first hear about the strike of the Liverpool dock workers?
Well, let me begin by saying I couldn't get any of the audio on this end. There's some technical problems, so I'll try not to be redundant with what Terry had to say. But we first heard about it. Actually, a friend of mine picked it up over the Internet, and I happened to be going to England. And so our union, the president of our union, Brian McWilliams, asked me to express solidarity greetings at a rally taking place in Liverpool for the dockers.
And what did you do on Martin Luther King's birthday?
Well, as was said earlier, we shut down all the major ports on the West Coast. And we'd also been in contact with other longshore unions around the world to support that action as well.
And what's been the response of the heads of the port, of the businesses you work for, in your strike on Martin Luther King's birthday?
Well, I believe there was a report on CNN where the head of the Pacific Maritime Association threatened to move cargo down to Mexico. But, you know, that's pretty much hot air because, as a matter of fact, they actually gave approval for the action. They were afraid if they didn't contain it to an 8-hour stoppage that it was going to spread, which is what most of the rank and file in the Longshore Union wanted, was a 24-hour shutdown up and down the coast.
This issue of privatization of the ports, can you talk a little about it and whether it is a threat to you on the West Coast?
Well, certainly. Privatization is a threat to workers all over the world. As a matter of fact, the Japanese longshoremen were the first ones to announce participation in the International Day of Action because the Ministry of Transport had said they're going to privatize the docks there. But in this country, there's was legislation in the last session of Congress to privatize everything from parks, highways, bridges, schools, to the ports. And I guess you saw the news a couple weeks ago where they want to privatize Social Security. It's as though everything is to be sacrificed at the altar of corporate greed in this country. And so we decided that the Liverpool dockers are taking a brave stand, and they need to be supported because in supporting their struggle, we're also supporting our struggle here.
Can you talk about what the structure is? Because for people who aren't dock workers or are very knowledgeable about this, they might not realize how it's run. Privatizing from what? Who runs the docks now?
Well, in most states in the United States, the port authorities are owned by the local governments. They constitute the port authorities. If it were to be privatized, it would be similar to subcontracting out or just simply selling the land that the cities own and the revenues from. In Oakland, which is probably not different than many cities and ports, a large part of the city's revenue comes from the ports. We're having a difficult time right now with the public schools, for instance, and getting funding for it. It would have a devastating effect on the local economy. Major shippers like American President Lines are already moving to put their ships under foreign flags, which would mean evading taxes and unions and so forth. And if the port authorities were sold out outright to private companies, it would even mean a further drain on the local economies.
I was just reading a message from President Brian McWilliams of the International Longshoremen's and Warehousemen's Union talking about how the Mexican government and the shipping companies are planning a new modern container port at Ensenada, just south of the California border, along with a rail connection to bring the cargo into the United States. How will that affect the jobs of people who work at the ports in San Diego and especially in Los Angeles, Long Beach?
Well, it's obviously it's going to mean a cheaper source of labor, and that poses a threat. We recognize that, but we don't see the Mexican longshoremen or Mexican workers as our enemies. In fact, in the wake of NAFTA, we sent a delegation down to the ports in Mexico to explain to them what NAFTA was going to mean. As you recall, Clinton was elected with a lot of labor support in this country, in part based on the fact that he said he was opposed to NAFTA, and then no sooner was he in office that then he pushed NAFTA through. And it has had a devastating effect on the Mexican working class. The unions that existed a few years ago no longer exist. The ports have pretty much all been privatized. The longshore unions that we were talking to have gone by the wayside. And so they're facing some terrible times in Mexico. And we will continue to make efforts to support them in their struggles. But right now, for instance, in the port of Veracruz, where they protested against privatization a few years back, the army was sent in to occupy the union hall. The union officials were arrested. The union was busted, and longshoremen that were making $8 an hour, which is a decent wage in Mexico, are now making $1 an hour.
Well, Jack,
and so those are the kind of...
Go ahead.
Yeah, go ahead.
That's
a sort of the problems that they're facing that are now.
Let me ask you something. Linda Chavez Thompson, who is the AFL-CIO Executive Vice President, was just elected Vice Chair of the Democratic National Committee. What effect will that have? I mean, can she do anything there?
Quite frankly, I think that's the wrong strategy for the labor movement. You know, the problem is the Democratic Party. They've been draining votes from labor for a long time, making promises, and then never delivering. I support the idea that workers in this country need to have our own independent party. In fact, I was a delegate at the founding convention of the Labor Party.
Well, let me ask Terry Teague, as you sit over there in Liverpool, about not only the actions and support of people here in the United States, but around the world that happened in the last week.
Well, what we're getting through now via our fax machine in Liverpool is most probably the best set of international actions that we've seen during the 16 months of our struggle. To date, we've had messages of solidarity and actions from 27 countries. And if you look at the range of those countries, they go from Australia to Bangladesh, 27 countries, 105 ports or cities. And every message has been a message of either workplace meetings, of demonstrations at British embassy offices, or actual direct physical actions taken against ships sailing to or from Liverpool. So clearly the dock workers in Liverpool and all the families would like to send a message to workers around the world, a message of thanks. And we know that if that type of support and solidarity continues, there'll only be one outcome to our struggle, and that will be a victory for the Liverpool dock workers.
Do you have a telephone number of you know, the central point of your strike, of your action in Liverpool, where people can call if they want to find out more information or support you?
Yes, we do. We've got a telephone number and also a fax number. If people want further information, they can call. We would be overwhelmed if they do call, and clearly we would also welcome fax messages of support. If we can give you the telephone
number. Yes, go ahead.
It's 00-44-151-207-3388.
So let me give that number again. This is in Britain, 00-44-151-207-3388.
That's the telephone number, Amy. And if I could also pass on a fax number.
Yes, go ahead.
Again, it's the same international dialing code. It's 00-44-151-207-3388. 207-0696.
That's 004-415-1207-0696. And this is calling Liverpool in Britain. I wanted to end by asking Jack Hayman, since you were talking about the Democrats and President Clinton and the support that the AFL-CIO has given for President Clinton, what your plans are now and what your union's plans are, considering the route President Clinton has taken.
Well, our union actually ended up supporting Clinton, which was not my personal position, but nevertheless, they ended up supporting Clinton. And I think we're going to have to keep on working in this country towards building an independent labor party. And by no means do I think that's a panacea. You know, part of the problem with the British dockers is that the British Labor Party ended up selling them out. And part of the problem is that Tony Blair is trying to keep things calm and actually undermining support of labor because he doesn't want to see this struggle go on. So we've got our work cut out for us in this country, but at least there is a Labor Party in Britain.
Well, I want to thank you, Jack Hayman and Terry Teague, for joining us, and we'll continue to follow the development of the Labor Party here in the United States. Jack Hayman, executive board member of the San Francisco Longshoremen's Union, and Terry Teague, shop steward and coordinator of the International Actions for the Sacked Liverpool Dockers. Democracy Now! Is produced by Dan Coughlin and Errol Maitland. Julie Drizin is our executive producer. If you'd like a copy of today's show, you can call 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening.